Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone. This is Mitch Rosen at Yield Street, head of real estate. I want to say, first and foremost, thanks, everyone, for taking the time to join us today. Very excited with our guest here, Seth Weisman. First off, I want to wish everyone, hope everyone's well and had a good summer and is dealing with the ongoing new normal. We certainly are and doing our best, and I know Seth is as well. Let me introduce Seth quickly and then we'll get started. So Seth Weisman is the founder and president of Urban Standard Capital, a fully integrated real estate private equity firm focused on debt and equity investments in the New York City metropolitan market. The firm manages $300 million of real estate equity and debt investments across its platforms. And I would also highlight that Seth and Urban Standard is the partner and originator on the Brooklyn multifamily loan that's currently on the platform. We've also recently closed a second loan that will be launched in the next few weeks, so keep an eye out for that. Seth previously worked at Perry Capital, private equity shop on the real estate private equity side. And before that, Seth was a member of the Goldman Sachs Investment Banking Division and graduate from Wharton at the University of Pennsylvania. I would also like to highlight some of Seth's philanthropic endeavors. In March of this year, during the COVID pandemic, he launched and founded an organization called Real Estate Has Your Back, which provided support and meals to various communities in the New York area, including Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens. And Seth, I want to say thanks for all of the good work you've done recently in that manner. And happy to have you here.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to speak to you, as always.
Same here. We've become friends, so I enjoy it. So, you know, the title of this webinar is, you know, do not write an epitaph for New York quite yet. And if you are a person who is reading the news or following, you know, what they may see, there's a lot of negative commentary around New York and what bodes for it. And I think a lot of it is just not correct information or not given the perspective. And so, you know, I want to just kind of dig right into it and get your thoughts. Do you agree with that view that don't write New York off yet? And if so, why?
Sure. So, you know, just to, you know, provide some additional context, you know, as you mentioned, Urban Standard is a real estate investment firm focused on the New York City market. But within that, we have three lines of business, two on the equity side. We have a development arm as well as a sort of value add arm where we own and operate about 30 buildings in Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens. And I want to mention that because while we also have an active lending business and platform, we have the benefit of sort of seeing information in real time from both sides of our business, whether that's, you know, condo sales or rentals or commercial collections. And so over the course of the webinar today, I'll comment on both, but you know, it gives us a unique insight. And on the lending side, what we can see what our clients are doing and the types of deal flow. But, you know, in terms of, you know, what's next for New York City and how New York City is doing, I think you sort of first have to step back and recognize that, you know, New York City, there's no one answer to that question because New York City has a lot of different asset types. And whether you're talking about hotel and retail, luxury retail, community retail, that all makes a big difference. Residential condo, are you talking about luxury condo, 3,000 a foot product in Manhattan? Or are you talking about more affordable $1,000 to $1,500 a foot product in core parts of Brooklyn? So it matters, and the story and the answer is a little bit different based on the asset type and also by neighborhood. I mean, I think, you know, and we'll go into this on the webinar today, but Brooklyn is faring a lot better than certain parts of Manhattan. So you know, the answer to the question is depends on what part of New York. But I think long term, you know, New York City is in a uniquely strong position. I mean, 20 years ago, it was much more heavily reliant on the financial industry. Today, it's a tech hub, it's a healthcare hub, it's an education hub, it's a legal hub. So you have a diversified base of industry that, you know, it's a creative hub that really positions it long term for success. And ultimately, I think that will be, that foundation will be the springboard for recovery. And then, you know, one other thing to add is, you know, New York City is, it's a city of ambition and doers and people who have hustle, right? And so, you know, people talk about, well, everybody's going to be working from home, and you don't come to New York City to make your career because you're somebody that likes to, you know, sit in your bedroom on a computer all day, not interacting with other people. So, you know, I think that demographic profile and the type of person drawn to a city environment, it, you know, that sort of that special sauce that creates that energy, that I think will continue. And I think it's going to be a couple quarters of a challenging environment, but long term, you know, I think we'll be in a good place.
I echo what you've said, particularly around the diversification of the economy in New York City, right? Like you said, 25 years ago, San Francisco was predominant hub of tech. And when you look at the deals that have been recently announced in New York, whether it be Amazon, whether it be Facebook, you mentioned TikTok in our call but yesterday, there is a real confluence, Google as well, where they have a huge campus downtown. There's a real confluence of forward-thinking companies that want to establish roots here and hire smart, talented people to grow their businesses. And that has only diversified the economy more, like you said, tech, education you mentioned as well. Like the marketing and advertising is a huge component of the New York City employment base. Real estate as well, right? Developers, owners, operators. And so I do think, in agreement with you, that 30 years ago, Wall Street and finance dominated the spectrum. I think that's really changed and provided a lot of tailwinds to New York City that is not going to change, not in the near term at least.
Right.
With that being said, you know, it's really hard to prognosticate about what happens. But we can do our best to kind of, based on what we know, what we see, we can try to make a smart thought process and hypothesis about where this stuff goes from here. So where do you think we really go from here? And how do you see a rebound looking like? What's going to come back first? What's going to maybe lag? And where are you kind of trying to focus your attention and time as you look at the broader investment space?
Sure. So, I think it depends on the asset type in when you're going to see a recovery. Certainly, it's going to be a challenging, quarter, probably next two quarters, right? As people, you know, return to work, you get past the election and hopefully the vaccine, and we get back, you know, to more sort of stable place. You know, we have been focused primarily on multifamily. I mean, I can speak to we have a couple hundred units that we own. You know, our residential collections through August have been just around 93%.
That's pretty strong. I mean,
it's
like
very strong. It's usually 100, but you know, it's still very strong. You know, the commercial retail has been about 55%. You know, we have a lot of, you know, restaurant tenants and nail salons and stuff like that. But universally, even with that collection level, we just entered into payment plans with those tenants to enable them to take the rent that they owe and sort of spread it over the duration of their lease or whatever period of time we can mutually agree. And tenants have been sticking to and making those plans as they have been reopening. So, you know, I think there's an element of like, we're all in this together and we all have to make it work and there's going to be sacrifice across the board. But, you know, I think you're already starting to see that retail come back. You know, community retail. I think luxury retail is going to be tougher. Stuff that, you know, is heavily dependent on tourism, that's probably going to be tough for the next couple.
Broadway, of right? Yeah, I think right. That's absolutely right.
But you know, multifamily, I think it's going to continue to be the strongest. I think industrial is going to be strong. I mean, you have for a couple of years strong demand for last mile retail or last mile industrial space and warehouse space. That continues probably, you know, it's going to be higher, more in demand than ever before. You know, healthcare related retail and office.
Yep.
I think that all continues. You know, the office sector, as you referenced, like we've seen some big leases signed. I mean, Facebook coming in with 730,000 square feet. You have TikTok taking 200,000+ square feet. Google's campus. Disney is building a 1,000,000+ square foot downtown headquarters. You know, the Google, like that. These are long-term planners. They're not planning for the next quarter or two. They may allow people to work, you know, from home or work, you know, a couple of days from home, you know, as we sort of rebound. But again, you know, nobody's making real estate decisions based on what happens in the next 30 days or 60 days. People who are making real estate investment decisions inherently have a longer term horizon.
These are 10-year, 15-year leases in some cases, right? So there is that huge runway of what they're planning for. And these are probably decisions they've been making for months, if not years, is how they think about growing their business. And they've chosen New York to make that footprint. So I think that's very helpful.
And even, you know, even in Amazon, and certainly, like, you know, a headquarters would have been great, but they continue to increase their footprint. You know, the Facebook leases, I think, in terms of a confidence booster for the city, was a big one, because yes, that had been, you know, in the works, I'm sure, in discussion for some time, but, you know, they didn't have to move forward with that, right? And so the fact that they did, that's a, you know, a real strong sort of sign of confidence. And, you know, we're going to probably be in a point where people are working, you know, maybe they're working remotely for a day or 2 days a week, and they're coming in the rest, and it's going to be a little bit of a hybrid. But people, you know, I think are eager to sort of get back to work and to have it, you know, to have a level of engagement that ultimately produces creativity and sort of thoughtful work product that is what businesses in New York, like the businesses we referenced, are known for and what ultimately they're selling.
And I would also add that people may not know that this is the Farley Building, which is basically next to what is now Penn Station, which has huge transportation component to it, right? So they clearly made the decision that people will be commuting at some future point, whether from Jersey, Westchester, Long Island, and that being in that central core is going to be a value to their employee base, and they wanted to kind of be positioned there. They didn't pick Midtown East, they didn't pick downtown, they picked literally at the center of all of the various subway lines and the commuter lines. So I think that's also a testament to how they see the long-term prospects for Manhattan and New York City in particular growing. And so that was one thing that stuck out at me is, now it was a big block of space, right? There's not many big blocks, but even despite that, they still chose to be where they were. And I thought that was a very telling move by them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, I know we talked yesterday in our prep session about, like, what role government has in civic bodies in supporting the rebound. And, you know, whether it be the CARE Act or other types of support programs for people out of work, or businesses, and getting, you know, the MTAs has a huge hole in their budget. You know, what are your thoughts on that? I know you've been involved in some civic organizations before, as well as your nonprofit. Talk through that a bit and where your head's at.
Sure. I mean, the city has a critical role, and the government has a critical role in encouraging, you know, economic activity. I mean, one of the, I wrote an op-ed for Cranes, and you know, one of the things that sort of come out of this, which I think is an important lesson, is how interconnected and interdependent we all are. Right, as human beings, as businesses, and that some of the rhetoric in the recent years in New York has been incredibly divisive, right? And there's sort of been this feeling of, you know, anti-business and anti-landlord. And the reality is that simply doesn't work, right? It doesn't work when you have 60% of the city's budget is paid for by real estate taxes, which are collected from rent, and you have literally 2% of the state's population pays 50% of the income taxes. Right. So you can't, you know, put your head in the sand and chase away economic activity. And I think you've seen the governor and even to a certain extent the legislature put the halt on some of these more radical, you know, cancel rent and this and that. And they've definitely taken steps to protect the more, you know, more vulnerable population, and, you know, some of their delaying evictions and foreclosures and the tax liens. And, you know, I think that all comes from a good place. But the government, you know, can't put itself in a position where businesses can't operate, right? Or they can't generate economic activity, or property owners can't collect rent, because then ultimately they can't pay their taxes. And so, you know, hopefully, I mean, the big push from the governor has been to put pressure, frankly, on the congressional delegation from New York to bring in federal aid, which is what they did certainly after 9/11, but even after Sandy, you know, they had these FEMA rent vouchers, right, to allow people who qualified. And all of that was designed to keep money in the system and flowing, because it is, you know, there's sort of the thin veneer of civilization. Like, there is, like, there's this dependence that, you know, the whole system could frankly crash if you don't have that payment processing and those, you know, financial flows. So the government, I think, state government has to continue to press the congressional delegation to bring in more money, but they also have to take steps to really encourage economic activity. And, you know, one thing that, you know, has come out in the last couple of weeks, which is a huge sort of change is that in the city council, there's this big industry city rezoning.
It's by
Jamestown. And historically, the sort of the city council has always deferred to the local council members, you know, opinion, right? And so in that case, the council member opposes this project. Now, this project is supposed to generate 20,000 jobs, $100 million in tax revenue. And what's been interesting is parts of the Progressive Caucus have actually come out in favor of the rezoning against the local council members' wishes. And that is an unheard of change.
Very, very rare. It's happened very few instances in the last, you know, 30, 40 years or so. And I think it's telling.
It is telling. I think people, you know, when you have members of the so-called Progressive Caucus saying they don't want Amazon 2.0 to happen again, I mean, that is a sea change from 6 months ago.
And I
think it's good because, you know, as painful as some of what we're seeing is in the New York, it is important for voters and electeds to see potential consequences when you make, you know, when decisions are made that ultimately undermine the economy. Because, you know, frankly, to have a to have a progressive city, you need to have a prosperous one, right? And you can't chase out economic activity because then you don't have the money for the programs. And the governor's really, to his credit, held the line on this. You know, and I'm sure the governor, you know, in the real estate community in New York, he's not exactly the most popular person, but he's come out and he said, listen, you can't raise the taxes on the wealthy. They're already paying more than 50% of the total amount. And there is an inflection point, you know, where you don't want to have people move. And so just recognizing that and being a responsible leader and steward of the city is important. And that kind of pragmatic progressive view is something ultimately what has to guide this recovery.
Yeah. And I think even to go from one as far to say, you know, come, I'll take you out to dinner or some kind of comment like that in terms of he recognizes the, I think he's in a tough spot. He's got to balance the people who elected the state legislator, right? And put him in power and support him, but also understand to your point, who's paying the bills, where's the money coming from, and how does the whole ecosystem work around rents, taxes, income taxes, real estate taxes. And I think, I think that's a correct statement. I think it's going to continue to evolve. But I do think holding the line on the more extreme views that you've highlighted is one that will bode well longer term for Manhattan. And with an upcoming mayor election this year, you know, we'll just see how that shakes out as well, right, during a time like this. A lot of uncertainty around that. Let's continue on. There's been a lot of talk as well about a quote-unquote mass migration out of the city, particularly Manhattan, in some cases Brooklyn. But the studies actually that have been done that I've read recently actually show that that's really not the case. People who were going to move out of the city because oftentimes they have young kids or starting school age, the school system in New York is not great, and private schools are a really cumbersome, difficult process. I know from my own experience, I personally left when my kids were entering preschool. A lot of people do that, space constraints, and want to get a house. That's probably been pushed forward due to COVID, and you've seen that now in home prices in the kind of a 25-mile radius around Manhattan really spiking, with rates also being as low as it is. What do you think about this kind of commentary and this talk of a migration out and how prolonged that is? Is it permanent? Is it temporary? Is it even happening? Like, what's your sense on that?
Sure. I mean, you know, the data on this is certainly – it's hard to pin down because it's happening in real time, and you know, some people who have left are have just left for a short period, you know. But I agree. I mean, I think you've always had in New York that dynamic where people reach a certain age, a point in their life, and you know, usually it's driven by something related to children, where you do just have space constraints that make you think about having a home with a backyard and additional, you know, amenities. But you know, I don't think that migration of like young professionals, I don't think you're going to see it there. You know, one thing that we have been seeing consistent demand for our studios, ones and even two bedroom apartments, the larger apartments that are, you know, either occupied as share apartments, you know, three bedroom, one bath type of things, or young families, that definitely has been softer. And I think, you know, either you've seen those share tenants move into studios and ones so that they're not, you know, sharing an apartment with two friends or strangers or whatever.
Right.
Families who are going to say, okay, well, maybe, you know, this was a move we were going to make 2 years from now, but now we're going to make it now or look at making it now. But you know, there are a lot of negatives, right? I mean, that still exists from the tax law changes, the tax reforms from a couple years ago, right? The fact that there's a $10,000 a year cap on your property taxes in terms of the deductibility, that's depending on where, what suburb you're looking at, that's a huge problem, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the $2 million house in Scarsdale with a $50,000 a year tax bill is, you know, it's a big number if you can't deduct it, right? Or if you can only deduct $10,000. So those dynamics still exist. And, you know, and I think you're still going to have young professionals who are going to want to be here and make their careers here. And, you know, I guess we'll see, but I think that is just sort of a short-term trend. I mean, anecdotally, I mean, I'm 37, you know, most of my friends are all my friends are young married couples with kids. To the extent they can afford it, they're coming back. They've rented temporary, you know, housing somewhere else, but they're all returning.
Right.
Right, they're returning driven by their schools or just the lifestyle that they want to have. And frankly, we've even seen, my husband and I, like in our conversations, it's people are also saying, well, you know what? Prices are up 30% in this submarket and 20% in that one, you know, and prices are down in Manhattan. Well, maybe now is the time to buy and take advantage of, you know, that sort of volatility and the dislocation in the market. So I've definitely seen that as well. You know, it's anecdotal, but, you know, it's a lot of anecdotes at this point.
Right. So we had Eddie, the founder of Nest Seekers, on a webinar earlier in the summer. And his mantra, I guess it's somewhat self-serving because he is in the brokerage business, but his view is that there are attractive deals to be had now and that people are going to look to scoop up once there has some more confidence. And that those who may act on the earlier side will get the benefit of that, and those who wait may not. We did get a question here, which I think is timely, just given what we're talking about, from Mr. Marvin Kim, saying, basically, given the medium and longer term horizon, as you think about the investment landscape, where do you think those compelling opportunities lie, particularly from a distressed, undervalued perspective? You mentioned residential, right? But, you know, a lot of talk, and this is, again, kind of like a narrative about distress, particularly in CRE, commercial real estate. You know, I'm going to hear your view. We've not seen on our side, the lending side, tremendous opportunities where we find that we can really step in and buy a defaulted note, or a bank's looking to move an asset they took back REO, or a borrower's in real distress and needs to raise some equity real quick. I mean, have you seen any of that? And if so, is that kind of where you're thinking the opportunities are going to lie looking out 3, 6, 12 months?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think some of the deferral of that opportunity set has been because of two critical factors. One, foreclosures have been deferred, right? You can't do it, right? And so that's given everybody, and this is by design, a little bit of breathing room. The second part of it is, I think most lenders, they want to work with their borrower, right? You know, we sort of talk about trying to work with people to land the plane in a safe manner. You know, this is a tough position. You know, I just don't know. Like, I mean, at Urban Standard, a third of our borrowers are repeat borrowers or referrals, right? So, you know, we look at our relationships with our borrowers as partnerships. And, you know, yes, we're in the debt if they're in the equity, but we want to them to be as successful as possible. And if that means extending a loan or modifying a loan, we're going to do that, as opposed to go to the market and say, sell it to, you know, somebody that focuses on distressed debt. So I think, you know, I think most lenders are trying to work with their clients. So I think those two things.
I think those are being forced to, Seth, a bit, right? Like, because of the restrictions, you know, particularly the hotel space, right? Like, are you going to take back the hotel asset and try to manage and run that? I think people don't want to do that.
Right? People certainly not. I mean, that's we don't lend on hotels because it's frankly an operating business and we don't know anything about it. But like, you know, there are people who do. And yeah, I mean, I don't think we're an unusual lender in that we also have an equity side of our business, and we own all these buildings and we develop them and manage them in-house. So like, that, it's not as scary, but we just don't want to do it. That's not what we, if we can avoid it and we can help the borrower get to where they want, certainly is going to be some, you know, financial probably pain because the market is what it is. But, you know, that's not something that we look to do. That being said, in terms of like where the opportunities could be, depends a little bit on your risk profile. But, you know, for us, we're sort of focusing on asset and credit quality. So the stuff that we're either buying on the buy side or lending on the lending side is prime locations, whether it's in, you know, Brooklyn or Queens or parts of Manhattan, existing buildings that have the opportunity for some type of value add repositioning component. And if it has retail, you want to make sure that it works at a rent where your tenant can make money in the space, right? The idea where, you know, you see a lot of this in, you know, parts of the Upper East Side on Madison and Soho, and, you know, where like it was a marketing play. Well, I don't think you should be relying, in my view, relying on a rent where the tenant cannot make money in its space. Right.
So it's a flawed strategy.
It's like the market's at 250 a foot, but they, you know, only 100 of it is justified by the sales in the space. Well, then I would underwrite $100 a foot. Right. And you know, we only own community retail, so that's been our perspective. But you know, if you're looking at stuff in prime Brooklyn, and we have a loan together where it's, you know, downtown Brooklyn or Borough Hill and Cobble Hill, and you know, you've got a bagel store, right, or a local, you know, bodega that are essential businesses, and they've been there for 20 years, and they're
fuel frequent, and that's something that's not going to be necessarily Amazon out of business. I don't think anytime soon, at least.
Right. You know, I go get a bagel on Saturday morning, you know, my bagel at Lox, and like, it's not coming on, you know, Amazon Prime. So, right. You know, and there's like a cultural element to going to the local place. So I think but you can buy, and you know, we have seen we've seen this on our equity side, but really on the lending side, where you've got these incredibly, you know, incredible quality assets, right? And you've got prime sponsorship, a prime quality sponsorship, and we're making loans at 300 to 400 basis points above where the lending bid would have been pre-COVID, right? So we're making loans on, you know, on great properties. And frankly, pre-COVID, we wouldn't have been competitive, right? To be able to generate and target mid to high digit returns on loans that in February would have been done by the conventional banks is a great risk adjusted return from my seat on the lending. You know, right. From our borrower's seat, they're saying, I can buy these prime assets at a 20% discount to where they sold on February 1st. Let me take advantage of that. And you're seeing, like, you see firms like Davian and Closed Properties and Conway Capital. I mean, they're leaning in, right?
Yes. They're saying, that's right.
For the first, you know, in the last 10 years, they're paying prices that they haven't seen. And they're saying, yeah, okay, this is community retail. Fine. There's one unit out of 10 that's retail, and it's trading at a 6 cap when 18 months ago it was a 4 cap. So that's a good trade for them.
I just elaborate. I think part of what makes you unique around Sandlit is that you own and lend, right? So there's very few vertically integrated lenders or investors that we have dealt with in the past. That's partly why I think we got super comfortable with the tri-state market, and particularly Brooklyn, given your background and your team's background and your boots on the ground and your ownership of other assets. So that's a very good point. That's partly how I think Yield Street thought of you guys as a partner. So, you know, we got another question here that I wanted to touch on. You know, this is a good one about rent growth, right? So, you know, you mentioned a couple quarters of some kind of bumps, if you will, or a transition market or period, I should say. Do you anticipate any real rent growth in the next, like, do you think of someone buying an asset right now, multifamily in Brooklyn, Manhattan, should be performing some form of rent growth the next 12 months? Or is that really more of a 22-23 kind of calendar year model?
I think it's more of a 22-23 calendar year model. I think unless you are making value add changes, right? So, you know, if you're going in and you're making a large one bedroom or two bedroom, or you're putting in a washer dryer, or you're a second bathroom, you're doing something that really substantially changes the product you're offering, you know, to bring it to market, then rent growth from that perspective. But just to say, okay, well, we have historically seen, you know, 3-4% rental growth per year for the last 10 years, and I'm going to project that out. I wouldn't do that on the equity side, and I don't think you need to. I think you can buy things today at a price where you have accretive leverage out of the gate. So, you know, on the equity side, we bought an $8 million portfolio in Greenwood Heights, and it was an in-place 6 cap. Well, and we borrowed from a community bank at, I think it was 3.7%. So we can make a positive spread out of the gate on that money between the 6% in place, you know, yield, operating yield, and our loan. And then there's all these value add changes that we can make. Now, right. I do think you need to be careful in terms of what the product type is to make sure that you're not moving the other direction, because there are things that, as I referenced earlier, are definitely softer. So if you have 4-bedroom, 2-bath or 4-bedroom, 1-bath apartments that are used to having, you know, younger professionals or students who are finding or used to find, you know, roommates on you know, sublet.com or Craigslist or whatever it was.
You're in trouble. Yeah.
That's not the right product for this moment. Might come back to that, but I think you might have to say, well, all right, instead of marketing this as a 4-bedroom, 2-bath, maybe this is a 3-bedroom and home office to a family and 2-bath. And yeah, it's not so much about $1,000 per bedroom per month. It's more, okay, $3,500 and just make sure that you're comfortable in that marketplace.
I do think that the housing stock in the Tri-State area that's been kind of neglected because they didn't necessarily need to put capital in to keep them rented at attractive rents and occupied are going to be the ones that you're going to look at and say, wow, I mean, this is just not priced right and there's better product out there. And so competition will come back for renter dollars. And I think you're going to start seeing some of that. And so if you have an older stock property, not well maintained, I think going just off historically on the strong New York City economy is not going to serve you well looking forward.
I totally agree with you. I mean, one thing that we've always done is, so we've sort of over-invested or overspent for the area for the time. Our feeling being that if we're buying something, right, and we are spending the time to take that unit offline, spend the labor dollars to renovate, you know, I never understood why people would do a renovation and like put in a Formica countertop and like, you know, white appliances. Like, it's not that much more for the materials. It's just, right, you know, it's 20% more, but you end up with a finish level that signals the quality, right?
Yep.
Similarly, when we design apartments, we think about, can a bed fit in here? Where do the light switches go? We always use a 8-foot door instead of a standard 6-foot, 7-foot door. They're little things that signify quality. And ultimately, not only do they, you know, historically, they allowed you to get the highest rent and get the highest quality of tenant. Now it has the additional benefit of retention because, right, yes, I'm getting $2,200 a month for our Bed-Stuy 1-bedrooms. And could you find one for $2,000? Probably, but it doesn't, or $1,800, but it doesn't have a washer dryer in it and, right, have a dishwasher and full size appliances. So it's actually ended up being a little bit of defense play for us because, right, we have the better quality product. And I think, yeah, if you're only competing on price, you're in, yeah, a challenge.
And frankly, people, I think historically, I remember when I looked for apartments, you know, maybe 10 years ago in the city, you know, you were fighting to get an apartment. I mean, you had to really, you know, have your deposit ready, your application filled out, your credit check done. And, you know, in some cases, it'd be like a food fight. And so if you did leave and didn't pay the higher rent, they'd have five people behind you to take it. I think now that conversation's flipped where it's like, okay, make me, I have a colleague who said, you know, I told them, make me an offer to stay. Right, which is unheard of. And so I think people are trying to play that a bit. And I think rightfully so. Now's the time when that probably is going to make sense to do that. There's another question we got. You talked about retail, neighborhood retail particularly, right? The question is, are you seeing any businesses looking to sign new retail leases or renew existing ones? And are you seeing brokers or tenants pushing for structural changes in leases, particularly around outs for pandemic or, you know, having the tenant become almost like a partner to the landlord, right? So there's a lower fixed base rent and that there's like a participation in the profit. So it's kind of a more hybrid model. Yeah. I would highlight, because you mentioned some of the positive news, SL Green essentially just did this with Love Madison Park on Madison Square Park, the very well-known restaurant. They basically gave them a runway and some working capital and reduced rent to get them back open and up to running.
Yeah.
And so I'll pose a question to you and stop there. But I mean, this has actually started to happen in some higher profile cases. I don't know how pervasive it is, but I'm curious if, you know, you do have some commercial real estate on the retail side. I'm curious what you think.
Sure. We haven't had to do that, you know, on the equity side of our business. And I think partially it's because it's community retail and it's more about, you know, deferring payments and making it sort of digestible over time. We've had some of our partners on the lending side where they have, you know, particularly if they have a tenant that is highly exposed in terms of the use to this business, right? So 11 Madison Park, that is a high-end restaurant, and that population has not been in the city. right, for the last, you know, 5 months, they're highly exposed. And so I think taking a percentage rent or doing some type of structural deal makes sense. And I have seen that on the lending side of our business, where at least for, I just saw this, a 12-month deal where it's percentage rent for the first 12 months. And then they had some type of, if in 12 months, there's still, you know, restrictions on dining.
It goes down.
No, it extends another year. I'm making up the numbers, but if it's 50% of sales is the rent for the next 12 months, but at the end of month 12, if there still are restrictions, then it extends another 12 months.
Right.
And the landlord in that case really, you know, what was their alternative? Right. So, and their tenant had just put in 7 figures of CapEx into the building.
Wow.
Right. And they want them to be successful.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that's going to become more, I do think it's become more pervasive. I think if tenants really push for some type of, I don't want to say partnership, but some kind of profit sharing or subsidy up front, at least from a landlord, I do think the expectation of tenant improvement dollars is going to be, you know, reduced. So the tenant will have to put up more of that capital. And maybe the landlord said, I'll put up less money and I'll work with you, but you need to come out of pocket to kind of do your build out and set your business up. A good question we have here that comes up a lot is, you know, what do you think about the future of co-working spaces in the city? WeWork has had so much talk about their failed IPO. Adam Newman leaving the company. They brought in the CEO of GGP. They've cut headcount dramatically and closed some locations. Do you have any particular thought on that market at all strongly either way? Or I have my own view. I'd love to hear yours first.
We have some office, but not a ton. I do think there is going to be a lot of sublet space on the market as people sort of adjust their space needs. And there is going to be a real question. If you're a small business that, you know, instead of taking a private office or a desk, you know, in a big co-working space where you're share, a big part of the draw was shared amenities, right? A shared kitchen, a shared, you know, whatever. I don't know that that's such a positive right now, right? Versus go into a building where, okay, you know, you have one other tenant that you're sharing a sublet 1,000 square feet with, and you can sort of get that flexibility because, you know, people are trying to lay off space without going through, you know, a WeWork type company. You know, I just don't know how people are eager. I mean, I know in our office, for example, we have a sort of trading floor section, and we're staggering where people are sitting, and we're using some of the private offices and conference spaces in a different way. You know, I don't know that the rent a desk that's, you know, 40 inches wide next to somebody you don't know, I don't know how in demand that use is going to be.
We have two more quick questions I want to touch on. One is about just kind of foreclosure deferrals and the headwinds that the real estate's facing in general. I'll answer this myself, and then we'll get to the last question. But you know, I do, the question regards around federal support and a second stimulus package and, you know, how much of this kick in the can down the road. And so I would say real estate moves in peaks and troughs or cycles are much longer. When you think about the stock market or public markets, in March as an example with the stock market, it went down, you know, 35% in a matter of 3-4 weeks. Real estate does not move that way. It takes a far longer period of time to see value movement. Leases are longer. Office, industrial, retail, valuations change slower. It's less liquid. It's less, it's more opaque. And so I think that historically, when you look at the RTC days in the late 80s and early 90s, you look at the crash in 08, not taking a hammer to the problem and trying to work with the borrowers and letting the problem work itself out over time with government support proved to be a good solution. And the banks had some runway to kind of, with the FDIC and the OCC, to get through that problem. I think right now, that is not that dissimilar. There's a ton of federal action occurring, whether it be the CARES Act or Fed interjection in the mortgage markets and the public markets. That's not going to change anytime soon. Rates are all-time lows. So I do think that even if there was a second, quote-unquote, wave of COVID, I'm not sure how that would look, but let's say there is something like that, I do foresee continued support and a desire to not kind of have this mass foreclosure process across all these assets at one time. It just hurts all of the assets and hurts government support for taxes, like you mentioned. So I think my personal answer to that is that is not going to change in the near term. I think if there's really a fundamental destruction of value in the real estate, then you have to take an action. But if it's something that is temporary and is kind of tied to a specific period of time, like a COVID scenario, I think lenders are apt to, and banks are apt to work with borrowers they show some goodwill, whether it be some partial payments, or they extend the loan, or they do something, maybe a rate forgiveness for a period of time. That's being done all day long. I think it's not going to change, really. Personally, I don't think it's going to change. Last question, which is really appropriate given our exposure with you guys on the Brooklyn deal, is what is the value you see in Brooklyn compared to Manhattan? Why do you think Brooklyn has held up better? And when you look at rents or condo sales or density, it seemed to have held in really quite well. Do you have a view on that? I know your concentration, your equity side is more Brooklyn focused also. So love to get your thoughts on that.
Sure. I mean, I think Brooklyn in some respects is, and certainly depending on the neighborhood, it is in some respects considered almost like a suburb, right? Like it's not as dense, that you have more outdoor space and you've got a variety of factors that put it in, I think, a stronger position than Manhattan. So, you know, I think those are reasons that it has, I think, performed better. It doesn't also have the glut of uber luxury condo where there's no clear rental fallback plan, right?
Yeah,
so one thing we always do when we underwrite new investments is, what does this look like if you have to rent it out and not sell these units? And if your business plan was predicated on selling something for $2,500 a foot and the market rent is 90, well, there's no real relationship there from a multiple perspective. If you're planning on selling something for 1,000 a foot or 800 a foot and the rents are 60 to 70, it may not be a great return, but there's a return, and that return allows you to live, right?
To live, right.
And we've seen this with some of our investments and some of our partners who have said, okay, I went into this thinking I was going to do this as a condo, but you know what? I don't want to make I've been working on this project for 3 years. You know, I'm out of the ground, I have my TCO or my CFO, I'm completed. You know, for me to sell today, instead of getting $1,500 a foot, maybe I'm going to get $1,250 because there's just not that as much demand. But $1,250 is not really the market, right? It may be where the bid is in a frozen thing. So they're going to say, okay, well, maybe I'll sell 20% at that price to effectuate the condo plan. And I think that, by the way, this speaks to the comment earlier from Nest Seekers, like people early who bring something to the table for a developer, like being one of those contracts that allows the effectuation of a condo.
A lot of value to that. Yep.
There's a lot of value there, right? So if you know, and if you're a savvy broker and you're like, you know that this developer needs two more units or three more units, they may take that and they might play around with, you know, the headline price versus concessions and case transfer tax and all
parking
that.
Parking spots. Yeah. There's always some work around that. Yeah, I get
but,
that.
But they'll get that, trigger the condo plan, and then they'll rent out the units and they'll say, well, you know what? Because for every $50 or $100 a square foot that they otherwise would be giving up by selling today, you know, they'll rent, they'll have a 4 or 5% yield, and in 2 years they can reevaluate. And maybe our, and you know, if the market's the same, it's the same. But if it's likely it's better, and that the spread of not giving up that $250 a foot what delta is likely worth it. And so we've seen that calculus. I mean, the calculus depends a little bit very much on the balance sheet of the borrower and the ability of the borrower to do that.
Yeah.
But you know, that's a way to avoid it. And again, all of this to say that in Brooklyn, there's always been. A tighter relationship as it relates to the rental fallback plan. Whereas in Manhattan luxury, what's to say something is 4,000 a foot or 3,000 a foot, or, you know, at some point you're comping on comps and it doesn't really, it can move it like dominoes the other way.
Yeah. I agree with a lot of what you said. When you think about the Manhattan market, you know, they're selling units out at 220 Central Park South, which is the Vornado property at 10,000 a foot, right? That's not what you're talking about. You're talking even at properties Upper East Side, where they were targeting 2,500 to 3,000 a foot, and they're just not selling through, and there's just a lack of demand. You cannot rent those at any level that, at least market level, that would make any sense. And even then, you're seeing owners now putting in listing them, right? So there's a whole dynamic on that.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a perfect example because, like, all right, a 220 Park Avenue set, like, that is prime location, incredible product, right? You had a lot of in this cycle, and this is going, you know, pre-COVID, you had inventory that was built that was sort of masquerading as uber luxury and asking for 3,000 a foot and didn't deserve it. It wasn't in a location that justified it. The finish quality wasn't there.
Right.
And so, you know,
bad views, all that stuff, right?
And you saw this, like, I mean, I actually think the finish quality of this product, of the Gary in Chelsea is great. right? But there is, I mean, they cut prices by 50%, they'll probably have to cut it additionally because there's so much beautifully designed luxury inventory in West Chelsea right now that, you know, if you're looking in that market, you have a lot of options. 220, you know, Center Park South, you know, that's a unique product.
Yeah. I just highlight that because it's like the 15 CPW of 2020.
Exactly.
Yeah. So with that, I want to say again, thank you, Seth, for joining us today. You did a great job. I really enjoyed talking with you and having our listeners learn more about you, your business, and your thoughts on the city. For all the listeners out there, thanks for joining us. Come again, and we look forward to check our website out, yieldstreet.com, for offerings. And there's some out there right now that Seth's involved with. So talk to you guys soon. Take care.
All right. Appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.